Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Brian Rice, Director of the Office of Wildland Fire at the U.S. Department of the Interior. Also joining me from IBM is Lisa Yarborough. So, Brian, you know, in the previous segments, you've talked about fires that must be suppressed and those that can burn. And I would like to understand your efforts in your office to work towards fire prevention. Could you tell us a little bit about what you're doing in that area?
Fire prevention is one of those elements of the fire program that is talked about in different ways. So the way I talk about fire, there's fire suppression. So when the fires are all burning and you see them on the news, there's fire suppression. Those are air tankers flying in the sky, helicopters moving people and dropping water, crews, smoke jumpers, all sorts of people that are engaged in fire. There's a preparedness component to fire. And preparedness is managing all of those resources before the fire, making sure people are certified, up to date, in shape, gears ready to go, technologies being developed. Then there's some of these other programs. I say programs, but they're actually other activities within fire management. One of them is prevention. There's several programs, Ready, Set, Go. WETIP is a program that's managed within the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Different places across the country have different types of programs. And ultimately, it's awareness about temperature, time of the year, if there's fire bans in place, put in place by state governments or other things, and not having campfires, putting your campfire out. So that kind of knowledge and information campaigns. And then what we're doing in fire prevention is actually working at it from the next path, and that's active management across the landscape. So there's numerous ways to deal with fire. So think about fire. This is the rudimentary way to think about fire is the fire triangle, right? Heat, fuel, oxygen. If you take out any one of those, you won't have fire, right? So how do we deal with it on the active management side of it? We're focusing on the fuel piece of it, right? So within that, managing fuels or active management on the landscape could be thinning of timber stands. It could be prescribed fire, which is where fire is intentionally placed on the landscape in a controlled setting, as controlled as fire can be controlled. And it actually cleans out some of those smaller fuels. And then in years when there actually is a bigger fire, there's more conditions that are prime for large fire activity, the fuel's not there to burn. So within the prevention piece of it, dealing again with people and then also dealing with the resource and managing it that way.
There's a term you mentioned, prescribed burns. What are prescribed burns and what role do they play in preventing some of the large wildland fires?
Prescribed fire or prescribed burns, you can use the terms interchangeably, are incredibly important. They serve multiple purposes. They have numerous roles. Let me give you an example of one in particular and what it actually did. In the Kenai or on the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska, near the town of Sterling, there was a prescribed or a fuel break that was built. And so by a fuel break, and I'll bring it back to prescribed burns here, but what the fuel break did was it created this large swath of land that had minimal trees, minimal vegetation on it. So as a fire comes through, there's nothing to burn. So the fire activity actually drops down. So prescribed fireworks in very much the same way, but the intent behind it or the way you get there is not by removing the material by hand or by tractor or chainsaw or anything else, but rather by placing fire on the ground. So in certain areas, boundaries and control lines are set. A lot of times a road or a path or a tractor trail is used as an anchor point and a fire is intentionally lit and it's let to burn through that entire area. And it allows bigger fires as they would come through to actually stop or come down to a much lower intensity or, you know, come down to a low intensity.
So what efforts are you pursuing to make sure these firefighters who are out there on the front line are safe?
Originally, I can tell you from personal experience, there was a time where it was expected that firefighters would go out and work nonstop for days. And that's changed dramatically to what we have today. And it's changed for the better. It's changed in a way that focuses primarily on the safety of our firefighters. So work-rest ratios have been developed. So for every so many hours that are work, there's a required amount of rest time that goes with it. The types of gear has changed. So fire shelters and other protective equipment called Nomex, the material that's used on the fire pants and shirts. Everything is changing in a way that focuses on safety. So that's one part of it. The training also that comes with it. So with bigger fires and different types of fire activity, there's higher needs for communication, for technology, for other types of activities that go along with fighting fire. So that's another piece of it. Working alongside all of our aviation assets. So a lot of times, like you see in the news, along with those big flames, you also see an air tanker flying over or an aircraft that's either dropping water or a red fire retardant mixture that also slows the fire. So it's the complexity that's changing also has increased the needs for safety training. It's also increased the needs for development of the gear that goes with it. And then I would say that the technology that's also coming along with it. So we haven't touched on this yet, but the development and use of unmanned aerial systems is growing rapidly in managing how we go through and actually capture data, manage data, and use unmanned aircraft when historically it would have been two or three staff members in a helicopter flying around with an infrared camera looking at the landscape. And so it's changing quicker, yeah, and it's changing in a really at a fast pace.
Well, that's a great point about the new technology. What other tools can incident commanders use to help them fight the fires or suppress them?
Incident commanders have a whole range of tools that come with them. They rely on them heavily. So many of the incident decision support tools that are out there, and by that I mean there's one in particular called the Wildland Fire Decision Support System. And right, so in the government, like a lot of places, we have these acronyms. So people refer to it as WFDIS, right? But the Wildland Fire Decision Support System. But what that does is it captures all of the inputs that are going into making a decision on a fire. Now, remember in the beginning, I was talking about the land use management plans and tribal interests, county interests, state interests, federal requirements that go with it. We have all the local residents that are involved as well. So how do we put that in a place that actually makes sense? How do we capture that in a way, right? And common sense might say, well, you put it in some kind of matrix and help you define a decision that captures the greatest good for everybody involved. And that's what the Wildland Fire Decision Support System does. It has mapping components that go with it and just brings it all together. So that's one of the places. We have a couple other tools that the fire managers can use. So one is Land Fire. And Land Fire is it's available on the web. Folks can find it. And Land Fire is another mapping tool that actually shows types of land cover. So it shows if an area has forested land or range land or if it's water or roads, and it shows population centers. And then it allows you to do different kinds of analytics that go with it. Probably the third place I would point to in terms of decision tools, it's another decision support tool that looks at our integrated fuels treatment systems, right? And so when I talked about managing and supporting prevention, right, by managing the landscape, so the fuels treatment decision support system looks at all these areas across the country. So think about, we have this patchwork quilt across our entire country that has state land, federal land, tribal land, county land, private land. And if a fire crosses bits and pieces of those land jurisdictions, how can you make sense of where to do the work and how to leverage funds between federal and state and local and all those places? So this is another one of the tools that can be used to aid in the decision. It doesn't make all the decisions, but it helps you get to the place to make a good decision.
So with all these decision support systems, it seems that the community would be primed to start leveraging some of the cognitive capabilities that are coming out today by industry. What are the plans for OWF or the community to start taking advantage of these cognitive capabilities that essentially learn over time in these decision support systems?
That is a great question, and that is probably one of our bigger challenges at the moment. I think we're primed to do a lot of that work at the moment. This comes back to working with people and building consensus, understanding what those tools are and how they can actually add value to the overall process, I think is really important. I think the piece I would add to it is a lot of times the federal and state and tribal firefighting forces are compared to some of the military forces in ways, you know, the special forces and those pieces that go with it. I think it's important to note what we do on a shoestring budget. To put a war fighter in the field has a certain cost to it. To put a wildland firefighter in the field has a certain cost to it. And usually it's a fraction of the other. And so it's an interesting place where we do incredible work.
So with the complexity of just within DOI, working with four bureaus, bringing this all together, can you elaborate for us on the funding and budget trends within OWF, knowing that different bureaus needs different things?
So the way that fire is funded really took shape in early 2000. And at that time, we had a large set of fires that came through in 1997, 98. And those on the heels of Yellowstone in 1988, South Canyon, and some of the other fires, Cerro Grande in 1994, a couple of the other mid-90s fires. There was an intent by Congress, by the White House at the time, to actually focus fire funding and really drive it forward. It made it a national priority in many ways. So the way that fire suppression is funded, it's based on a 10-year rolling average right now. So it takes the last 10 years, how much did it cost, average it, and then that's what the expected or targeted funding amount is for the next year. There's different legislative fixes that have been proposed by different members of Congress that look at treating that 1 or 2% of the fires. Remember, I talked about 97-98% is what we can take care of, and we know we got them within, you know, first operational period. But those 1 or 2%, those make up a huge lion's share of the cost overall. So what happens if they are treated as a natural disaster and funded out of different places? So there's numerous proposals that members of Congress have put forward. And so that could actually change the way our business would operate. And so we're always looking and analyzing what would work and how would we make it work if we were directed to do that.
What does the future hold for wildland fire management? We will ask Brian Rice, Director of the Office of Wildland Fire within the U.S. Department of the Interior, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.